I would just suggest.
That's the issue, is that
really, no, it's about the name.
What's the deadline? 15?
Well, no, that's deadline for one policy. It's going to be March 28th.
Is that the second deadline? Did we miss the first deadline?
We only have to do it in one of the boxes.
Right.
We did it.
Yeah. Oh, hi, Lindsay. Good. How are you doing? Excellent. Yeah. Nice to meet you. Oh, you're testifying. Oh, you're testifying this one. Oh, excellent. Good. That's right. Okay. Sorry, I can't keep a lot of stuff back. Well, why don't you have a seat? Yeah, Chair Mariani said we're up first. Yeah. Okay, excellent. I don't know. I don't think so. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 1055 is a bill that I introduced a couple of years ago now when there was that high-profile case in New York where the police officers, quote-unquote, had sex with whether it can be called that consensual or not when a woman's handcuffed or in custody is, I think, a matter for debate. But nonetheless, I brought the bill, and we weren't in charge, so I think it was Kelly Fenton, former Representative Fenton, who brought the bill as well. But she got the hearing. Mine didn't because, you know, you guys are in the majority, which is fine. But then I think that was in Omnibus Prime, but I can't guarantee that. Was it? Yeah, okay. So it was in there, and so it didn't make it into Omnibus Prime. So we're back here with my bill that prohibits the police officer from doing so for a person who is restrained. And it provides an exception for lawful searches. So that's what it is. And I have Min Casa with me who can help testify in support of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce your name.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Lesh. My name is Lindsay Bryce. I'm the Law and Policy Director for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I've been in front of you a few times this session already. I'm here to speak in support of this bill and to thank Representative Lesh, co-authors, and everybody who has shepherded it through over a number of years. The premise of this bill is straightforward, that there should be no sexual contact or penetration of a person who is physically or constructively restrained by a peace officer. Yet this happens. The example that you gave was a New York example. I can tell you that this is happening in Minnesota. I've spoken with victims and survivors and advocates who recount this experience. These folks are rarely, if ever, seeking to report, so you're not going to see a lot of these cases being reported at this point, and they're fearful of reporting for fear of not being believed or suffering retaliation for reporting. Now, this is not a metro problem or a rural problem. It happens in communities across the state. Again, I've spoken to folks who have experienced this in varying ways, both in the metro and in rural Minnesota. When someone holds the power to detain, when they have a weapon, when they have the ability to access data, they also have this power of credibility. And it doesn't matter whether there's been a formal arrest or not. When any sort of sexual contact occurs, there's an inequitable power balance. And our criminal sexual conduct statutes are, that is what our statutes are based on, inequitable balances of power. want to emphasize that the vast majority of officers don't engage in this behavior. This is not a most officers or anything of the sort. However, this situation happens often enough that we need to add this clarification to our statute, much in the same way we added it for corrections officers who hold a similar power over folks in their charge. MnCASA's member programs confirm that this is happening, and the examples include everything from traffic stops to harassment by law enforcement in the rare instances when a report is made about an officer. One of the most frequent examples occurs when a person is stopped for some sort of prostitution-related offense and a sexual favor is demanded to excuse a potential charge. In my opinion, this last example is particularly low because it shows that despite our efforts as a state to be more responsive to those dynamics and the dynamics of trafficking, that some of those tasks with addressing the issue are still choosing to exploit. This statutory change will help address that. I know there's been some conversation that this is already covered in statute. That is not our interpretation. However, even if there is an argument that it's already covered, there is value to, just like we did with corrections officers, saying this is behavior that's not acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Price. The members who are in court, although officially together, and Representative Brecht, your motion is to lay over the bill, lay over House File 1055 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Ms. Chair and members, I don't think we have any other testifiers at this point.
Okay. Why don't we do questions for you and Ms. Price, and then we'll open up others in the public who may want to testify. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Lesh, thank you for bringing this forward.
Not used to the Senate system. We have to turn the microphones on yet.
Typical.
Members, I apologize. I was instructed to instruct you that that's how it works. There's a switch right in front of you, and I guess you have to toggle it up and then toggle it back down when you're not speaking. So, Representative Johnson.
Representative Lesh, I want to again thank you for bringing this forward. It's an important issue. I was a little concerned about the testimony because I know we have very highly trained and highly professional law enforcement officers in the state. And the ones I've talked to over the years that we've been discussing this bill, everyone wants this because they don't want no clarity. I've been trying to find any instances in the state of Minnesota where law enforcement are doing this because I believe an officer is involved in this. He should be fired immediately. I'm just wondering if Ms. Price has found any actual cases that have come forward or not.
Ms. Price.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I can tell you is that from my work in this field, I've been working in this field and with victims and survivors of gender-based violence in a variety of different ways since the 90s. And I'm not going to give you a specific example because the specific examples I have are all confidential and they're all things that I know from my prior work as an attorney. They aren't folks that would be comfortable coming here testifying. I can tell you that I have heard these examples. I absolutely agree with you that we do absolutely have highly trained law enforcement in Minnesota and the absolute vast majority of law enforcement is completely appalled by this sort of behavior. And I can tell you that I know it still happens.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Ms. Price, thank you for that information. I know in my career, the only time that situation has come up is when I was propositioned by one of the persons that I had stopped, and we actually charged them out for it.
Very well. Are there any other questions? If not, is there anyone in the audience and the public that wishes to testify for or against House File 1055? All right. Chair Lesh, I guess you get the last few words before we then move to lay the bill over.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I guess between the statements of Ms. Bryce and Chair Johnson, I agree. I think this is a broad consensus issue, and I appreciate your support.
Very well. The chair then moves that House File 1055 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Considine.
Move approval of the minutes.
Chair Considine moves adoption of the March 7th minutes. Members, have you had a chance to glance at them? Very well. All in favor of the motion to adopt the minutes of March 7th, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And members, before I forget, so tomorrow we've got a pretty long day. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Wednesday we have a pretty, tomorrow we don't have a long day. That's the good news, at least not this committee. And I've been advised by my minority lead that my initial notice that we'll be meeting at 5 and then possibly 5:30 would violate the ability of our caucuses to meet. And that was my oversight, and it's certainly not my intent to do that. Your caucus, I believe, Lee Johnson, meets until 6:30.
Scheduled until 6:30.
So the chair is going to modify his call to immediately after the end of our caucuses. That might be at 6:30. It might be at 6:40. It might be at 6:45. I will certainly make sure that we have space for members to show up, but I'd like to get moving and have the testimony being presented. So we'll meet on Wednesday immediately after let me put it this way. We'll meet immediately after our last, whichever caucus meets the longest, immediately after that. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I know for Wednesday we have a large number of bills. I would suggest finding the largest room possible because so we can, with other committees going on, be able to adjust the agenda as far as who's available to testify.
Very well. Thank you. Good advice. Right now we're scheduled for room 120. Hopefully that should work. It's where we've been meeting regularly, and I think it's got hopefully enough seats for our gathering. So next... I'm up next. Vice Chair Edelson, I'm wondering if you can take over the gavel, and I'll go forward and present the next bill. Madam Chair, I would move that House File 334 be laid over for possible inclusion in our division's omnibus bill.
Very good. Go ahead, Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I failed to bring my bill forward with me, so perhaps the page can send it, although it's pretty simple language. That's actually my first comment, members, that this is technically a pretty simple bill. It adds two members to our Pulse Board from the general public. My hope is that the simple notion of it doesn't detract away from the important outcome that I hope we'll be able to pursue as a result of expanding the board in this way. And I believe that doing so also reflects the values that we hold in common here, which is that the general public should have strong ownership over our important work with raising the level, keeping, maintaining, valuing the high level of rigor and professionalism of our police officer community in the state of Minnesota. The board currently has two county sheriffs, by statute, this is prescribed. The board needs to have two county sheriffs, four local police officers, of which two should be chiefs of police, two general peace officers, one that should come from our state patrol, two peace officers involved in peace officer education programs, the superintendent of the BCA, one member from higher ed that offers police officer education programming, one local elected, so this would be from a local political jurisdiction, and then two members from the general public. That comprises 15 members, 10 of which are directly, in one way or another, expected to be peace officers. 12, if you count all peace officers and those who are involved in some aspect of peace officer work, so superintendent of the BCA, for instance. This bill would add two more to the general public, so we're not creating a new category. We have placed the value in general public's presence on the Pulse Board for many years. This would add two more members, which then would comprise four of the 17. So we'll expand the board. Four of the 17 members is coming from the general public. The goal here, as I alluded to earlier, is meant to enhance the perspectives and the voices to the strong work of our Pulse Board, which enhances both the relevancy and the professionalism of our law enforcement officers. As you all know, the Pulse Board does a number of critical functions. Obviously, it licenses our police officers in our state. It certifies training programs by which we expect our police officers to acquire the knowledge and the skills to be good, strong public servants. It develops and administers the tests by which these individuals obtain their license. It obtains information about those who are seeking a license, so making sure that we've got folks with the kind of backgrounds that we want to see in our law enforcement ranks, particularly vetting through for any possible wrongdoing in the past. It assists law enforcement agencies to establish written policies. We began this session by hearing directly from the Pulse Board on their work to develop a model for sexual assault investigations that was triggered by a large public focus and outcry about the state of our investigations work in this area. So they developed that policy and shared that widely with law enforcement entities across the state. And then it enforces licensing sanctions in the event of failure to meet any of the standards that they have developed and that we, by law, expect them to develop. All of these are smart, needed functions to ensure both rigor and quality of our law enforcement sector, and it provides also ways for citizens to add new insights and perspectives to strengthen the relationship between our police officers, our peace officers, and the communities they serve. Members, in keeping with our theme of community-centered public safety, where one of the core tenets is that law enforcement work is about participating in community problem solving, and community problem solving by definition requires the community to be there. I think we see a good representation of that concept in the current makeup of the Pulse Board, and this effort is really intended to bolster and strengthen that by bringing in two more members from the general public. I failed to mention at the beginning of the hearing that as you look at the bills, we've got teed up today in particular, that and many of the bills for the rest of the week, that our goal is to really have a police professional excellence focused week. Members, I come from communities where I grew up in Chicago, and I've lived in communities here in the Twin Cities where, unfortunately, the trust level between those who are in community, who are many of our peace officers patrol and strive to maintain the peace, where relationships often get pretty strained. That happens. No surprise here, particularly when you have differences in income backgrounds between our peace officers and the communities they serve, and especially when you have racial, linguistic, cultural differences between them. I don't think that we are condemned, if you will, to a state of constant tension between those communities and our law enforcement community. I think the opportunity, in fact, the duty, is for us to be driving policy that strengthens relationships between communities and the law enforcement public servants that are entrusted with their public safety. My hope is that this bill, by adding additional perspectives, preferably from those communities, so opening up the possibility that that indeed can happen, can go a long way toward getting us to a better place consistently across the state in terms of good, strong relationships, which are absolutely vital for the delivery of sound public policy in Minnesota. So with that, Madam Chair, we do have some folks who wish to come and testify on the bill, on behalf of the bill, and I ask you to call them forward.
Thank you, Chair. All right. Would the first testifier, Anika Bowie, thank you, from the NAACP Vice President, please join us?
Thank you, Vice Chair. My name is Anika Bowie, and I'm representing the NAACP Minneapolis branch. And I'm also in support of this bill, HF 334. I think this is a really encouraging, expansive bill that I think everyone can agree on more representation present on the post board. I'm also here in capacity as the St. Paul sworn commissioner of the Police Civilian Internal Affairs Review Board. And just even hearing the language of this bill really speaks to the nature of why there needs to be more representation. My experience as a commissioner who represents my community for Ward 1 in St. Paul is to investigate and have a credible voice, a transparent voice, as well as an honest voice. Someone who has that credible voice for the community. And I don't think there's enough opportunity for the public to be stakeholders. I think in support of this bill, the public will feel like their voice actually matters. So when there is crisis, that when they're in the streets or when they're in community listening sessions or forums, that their experiences does not go on deaf ears, that they will be professionalized in a manner to where they can clearly articulate and have a seat at the table. Also, my experience as a college graduate from Hamline University, I majored in criminal justice, and I took several courses, actually, on the post board. And the question always remained was, we need more women of color to be police officers. But when I saw who was on the post board or saw who was a representation of our police department, I didn't feel like I would have a seat at the table or that was a career that I can see myself being inside of. So credibility is extremely important. It not only gives a voice, but it gives opportunity for a future of the next generation to be part of our system as well as part of our governing body as police officers. And it also alleviates the disconnect that we all know that have been happening for years and years and years and years. This is an opportunity to build that trust, to nourish that trust. This is also an opportunity for those who have come from neighborhoods, like Chair Mariani had said, where trust has been burdened, damaged over time, for people from the community to walk into their leadership and have a credible opportunity to be stakeholders. I'm here, you know, as a vice president for Minneapolis NAACP, and we see this as an opportunity for community organizations to be present. Also, we have strong relationships with faith-based organizations. We see this as an opportunity for them to be present because we are the community organizations that have to deal with the aftermath of crisis. And how can we make sure that we are making sure that that voice and that narrative and those concerns are heard on this post board in a manner that is documented, in a manner that is legit, in a manner that is substantial. So I just want to say thank you. Minneapolis NAACP is fully in support of this bill. We see it as a way of building credibility as well as building out a future for more representation on the post board.
Thank you, Ms. Bowie. I really value what you're saying in terms of having the community having a stake at the table, so thank you so much. Our next testifier, Justin Terrell, Minnesota Council on African Heritage. Go ahead, Mr. Terrell.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. And please
Chair.
State your name for the record, too.
My name is Justin Terrell. I'm the Executive Director of the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. And I just want to say thank you to the Chair and the leadership of this committee and the members and the staff. Once again, it's another exciting week in the Public Safety Committee. You guys are doing a great job, and I'm excited about the opportunity to talk about my support for this policy. I just want to ask everyone to support this bill. The council, as many of you know, we represent all African heritage folks in the state of Minnesota. It's about 425,000 people. We advise the governor and the legislature on issues that impact that constituency, and I'm happy to rise for this occasion to give you my advice to support this bill. We have 150 years of policing in the state of Minnesota. The post board, I think, came around somewhere between the 60s and 70s to set standards for law enforcement in our state. And what I like to call is, you know, we have evidence that we still have a lot of work to do around law enforcement in the state of Minnesota. A quick anecdote is that this morning I got an email from a black publication, the spokesman, highlighting a new BET six-part documentary series that dedicates an entire episode to police misconduct and issues in the city of Minneapolis. The whole world is watching what we do in Minnesota when it comes to police misconduct and how we work together with communities to address this issue. And as someone who represents the entire state's population of black and African folks who consistently raise this as an issue, the issue of police misconduct, My hope is that we will have the support to expand the number of community members on the post board, where it's simply a seat at the table for establishing strong standards and making sure we're having the conversation around law enforcement standards where we need to have it and that we're there and that we're part of that. Just a quick personal story before I wrap up. You know, every other week I sit at a table with police and black men. I sit down, and this we've been meeting for the last 2 years. And so when Philando happened, you know, I was at a table with officers. When during the Jamar Clark situation and the aftermath of that, I was at the table with officers. Body cameras, I was at the table with officers and community members and black men. I know what it means to sit at a table with law enforcement and wrestle with these issues. And I will tell you, and I will share with this body that, in my opinion, that's the only way forward. We have to commit to working together and making sure that we keep the main thing, a focus on public safety for everyone. And the way that we do that is through collaboration. So by expanding the table at the post board, I believe that's a simple step that we can take together to increase the spirit of collaboration. I've spoken with law enforcement on this policy, and I know that they support it. I think law enforcement, I can't speak for any one specific body, but I know that there's folks in law enforcement who appreciate being at the table with community in ways that can provide cover for difficult decisions, but can also provide accountability for changes that they need to make. I mean, all of us sit at the intersection of many different interests, and having community at the table ensures that the right voices are there to help us get through those moments of tension, if you will. So I'll conclude my comments there, and I appreciate, once again, the leadership of this committee moving this conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Terrell, for your testimony. Lars Negsted from Isaiah, if you could join us at the testifiers table. And please state your name for the record, sir, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Lars Negsted. I'm the policy director for Isaiah. Isaiah is a statewide organization of clergy, congregations, and people of faith working for racial and economic justice. We have over 200 congregations that are members across the state. In my own tradition, Lutheran Christian tradition, we are in the time of Lent, and so I'd like to open with a verse from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, verse 9. Blessed be the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. So from our perspective, the notion of adding some more community seats to the Peace Officers Standards and Training Board makes a lot of sense. There's obviously problems in regards to relationships between police and the community, and we think more hands on deck is only a good thing. It will provide more transparency, more community involvement and engagement, and we applaud this as a positive step in the right direction. So thank you, for Chair Mariani, for bringing this bill forward, and we urge you all to support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nextive, for your testimony. Chair Mariani, is there any public testimony? Seeing none, we can take questions from members. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Chair Mariani. When I was reading through the bill, the very last paragraph talks about geographic diversification, so choosing people from all corners of our state. And in some of the lines of the existing language, it specifically calls out that there needs to be that diversification. Others aren't as clear, but the last paragraph sort of sums it all up, that overall there should be this geographic diversification. And I'm just wondering, author's intent, as you add two additional members, is your thought to have it be more metro-centric or just represent the whole state, you know, if you've given thought to that?
Chair Mariani.
Madam Chair, members, I've given some thought to that. I've gone back and forth about just how prescriptive, to be. Obviously, you've heard from some of the testifiers, as well as my own observations about the unfortunate chasm that exists between racial and cultural communities and the bulk of our law enforcement. Obviously, our law enforcement is also diverse. I think many of us want to see it be more diverse. I was actually just commenting with Ms. Bowie about St. Paul, where I read recently that don't quote me solidly on this, but I recall that in a recent article that we have no African-American women left at our St. Paul Police Department. I'm seeing nods from Representative Pinto shares representation of my city with me. When at one time we had several, I would work with several of them back in the, oh my gosh, in the 80s.
Only four in entirety of the police
there
department.
There was only four.
Only four African-American women
in the entire of the history of the police department. And so for me, that really begs the question about, you know, are we doing everything we can to be able to diversify our law enforcement? And so I am a little bit back and forth here about, you know, maybe, you know, maybe Carlos, you ought to add a little bit more prescriptive direction. I've chosen not to do so at this point. Want to continue to have that conversation. We are a big state, and I've gotten all over the state many times over the years. And so I certainly see the wisdom of having the geographic language here. I suspect that, you know, choosing from, like, county sheriffs, you know, from educational institutions, you know, we could maximize, you know, our ability to choose geographically. I also know that our state is getting racially and culturally diverse pretty much in every corner of the state, so that should also help. So in all honesty, I am wrestling with that, whether or not we should even be a little bit more prescriptive with that. Clearly, for the record, myself and our testifiers are raising one particular strong need for diversity within the Pulse Board itself.
Representative O'Neill, do you have a follow-up?
Just quickly, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you for that. I just wanted to raise that as a conversation piece and kind of see where you, the author, are kind of going with it. You know, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking about, you know, the reservations, Red Lake in particular, White Earth, Leech Lake, Fond du Lac. So there's that representation that's not specifically spelled out. There's, you know, there's minority populations sort of, as you said, dispersed across our state in every little corner. So I just was wondering what your thought process was. Since now we're going from two to four, there's an opportunity maybe to give some guidance to the governor, as the legislature should, if that was your hope, you know, and if you wanted to keep it more metro-centric, I just wanted to see what you were thinking there. But, you know, there's different situations across the state and different challenges. So just thought I'd see where you were coming from and move that conversation forward. Thank you.
Well, and Madam Chair, just for the record, I don't have a particular leaning in terms of metro-centric as much as truly a statewide presence, which, of course, the metro area is a part of. But my hope is that we're not directing this bill to be, in essence, a bill that's going to pull members solely from the Twin Cities metro area.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Chair Mariani, I guess I don't really understand the need to increase, but we all have our own opinions. I know I've been involved with the Post Board for many years because I was a peace officer. One thing I'm wondering, we had that horrible incident that should be coming up in the court here pretty soon with the Mohammed Noor killing of Justice Diamond and or Damond. Concerns are raised about the mental health fitness of police officers. I'm just wondering, should the Post Board require law enforcement agencies to adopt a psychological test for officers and officer candidates?
Chair Mariani, and can we be clear? Is it Justine Damon? I just want to make sure we're getting the... Okay, thank you. All right. Chair Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, first of all, on its surface, that makes a lot of sense. But more importantly, it seems to me that that's the type of deep deliberation and exploration that this board needs to do. And I suspect they've been doing conversations around this issue, but I'm not certain.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Chair Mariani, and for the members of PLUC, just so you know, when I got into law enforcement to go to school in 1984, I'd do a psychological test. They're already doing them. To get my job, first job, I had to do a psychological test. To get my second job, I had to do a psychological test. Law enforcement does this stuff all the time. Our post board has done a very good job. One thing, if we do go to four members from the public, I would suggest an amendment. That'd be two in-state and two out-state. In the 80s, when I was in law enforcement, we had some good training if you were a metro department. If you're a greater Minnesota department, the training was worthless, yet we had to take it to maintain our license. They made under the Plenty administration, they made a very wise choice to split that up, because law enforcement in greater Minnesota is different than law enforcement in the metro area. So we made sure we had it real diverse, not just geographically, so the post board could address the needs of all the departments, all the officers, and all the citizens of Minnesota.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I think there's wisdom in your advice.
Members, it looks like we don't have any more questions. Chair Mariani. I'll have you down. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought you looked my way, and then I saw you write down, and I thought you were writing down my name. Evidently not. So to that point about the metro area versus the more greater Minnesota, I mean, I'm curious, and does the post board meet other places than just, in St. Paul? Because, if I'm someone from far north, and every time I had to come down for a post board meeting, it'd be nice if occasionally they came up to my part of the state. I'm curious, do you know if they only meet in St. Paul or if they meet in other locations as well?
Chair Mariani.
Madam Chair, members, there might be someone in the audience that could answer that question. I don't know. And Representative Dean, given the state of broadband in parts of greater Minnesota, that makes it an even more challenging proposition.
Director Goh, do you want to join?
Limits the ability for folks to meet alternatively, in alternative ways, that is.
Hi, Madam Chair and members. Nate Gove, Executive Director of the Post Board. Within the last 4 years, we have not had off-site meetings. I do know in the history of the Post Board that they have done that. I think that's kind of the call of the chair as to where they would like to host them. And I think a lot has been reflected as to why it's been in the metro, as the vast majority on the board are from the greater metropolitan area.
Thank you, Director Goh. Representative Johnson, do you have anything to that? No. All right. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, So Chair Mariani, just in light of that, since it already is written in statute that it's supposed to be diverse and it's scantily diverse, that might push your thought process maybe just a little bit more to make it a little bit more diverse, because we do have different cultures across the state. So I would just encourage, now that you've heard that it's really not particularly diverse across the state, that might be something that you would consider maybe tightening language just a little bit so that there's at least representation across the state. Thank you, Chair.
And Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think there's wisdom in that as well. Director Gove, we were just whispering, and he thinks that the numbers might be close, but he wants to do a count. So once he does that, I'll share that back with committee members as well.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Representative Dean. A couple of quick questions. How often does the post board meet?
Madam Chair, Representative Poston, I'm going to defer to Director Gove here.
Madam Chair, members, four times per year, quarterly, for board meetings. Another approximately four meetings for subcommittees, depending on the assignment. Other committees can be more. The bylaws committee is not particularly busy as of late.
Representative Poston.
Madam Chair, thank you. The meetings are all held in St. Paul, and someone mentioned using technology. Do you do that at all? Have people stay out at their homes, or you know, out in greater Minnesota and participate in those meetings through technology, or are all the meetings held in St. Paul?
Madam Chair, Representative Poston, we have not, we don't have those capabilities for like a webinar. They are held at the St. Paul Post Board offices.
Representative Poston, and members, we are going to try to keep this brief because we have testifiers on the next bill. Yeah,
Madam Chair, very quick question. Chair Mariani, I'm assuming that there is some compensation for these board members and some travel pay and so on, so there'll probably be a small fiscal note, I would imagine, that will go with this.
Madam Chair and Representative Poston, that is my understanding, and don't hold me to this, but looks like possibly $2,500 to $5,000 a year, depending on what region. But Director Gold might have more information. We'll certainly, you know, be pulling a note on it to get those numbers clear.
Thank you.
Director Go.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Poston, that's correct. I did turn in a fiscal note that has not yet been signed off by the DPS EBO, but that was my general range. We do pay a stipend, mileage, potential hotel and meal cost requirements, depending on if it's an outstate appointment as opposed to Metro. Kind of worst case scenario is what I put forth.
All right, members. Chair Marion, do you have any closing statements?
Madam Chair, I don't. Other than to thank the committee members for the probing questions, I do think that there is a shared interest among committee members to be able to maximize the general public's participation in the Pulse Board as the Pulse Board continues to raise the level of quality and rigor. And I do think that there is an I didn't really much say about, I guess I alluded to it with the observation of African-American women in my city's police department, but I think that there are some benefits to harvest here relative to being able to assist, inform, be part of the conversation with local law enforcement in terms of recruiting and retaining a diverse, particularly racially, culturally diverse peace officer cadre. So I think the upsides are good on this, and we'll come back to this issue as we put together our omnibus bill, and hopefully it can enjoy the full support of all our committee members.
Very well, Chair. And so we renew your motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Ellison, I was moving slowly in the hopes that you would just stay here, but that trick didn't work. Members, next we have House File 627, Representative Pinto. And Representative Pinto, I believe your motion is to lay over 627 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Very well.
This is on, correct? Yes, okay.
I can hear you anyway. Yeah. That's very well. House File 627 is officially before the committee. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There's a nice summary sheet from the Innocence Project of Minnesota regarding House File 627. This would require the creation of a model policy articulating best practices for eyewitness identification and promoting those practices statewide. I should note that I'm quite familiar with this process, and you'll see members in the bill There's a series of aspects of the policy to make sure that when there is eyewitness identification, that the person who's being identified is in fact the person who was seen committing the crime. My own jurisdiction in Ramsey County, where I prosecute, these procedures are used and have been quite successful and very helpful. I'm inclined, Mr. Chair, to simply move to my testifiers who can provide a little bit of background, and then we'll open up for questions. So. Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. Thank you for that. The A1 amendment is simply clearing up a technical reference that was raised by House Research, and I really appreciate that, simply correcting a statutory reference. Aye. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Chair, I was just giving some of the background for the bill. And at this point, what I'd like to do is to move to my testifiers. They'll give a little bit of brief background as well, and then we'll just move to any questions members may have. Thank you. So we'll start with testifier to my right. You get introduce yourself.
And you can. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nancy Stabli. I'm professor of psychology at Augsburg University in Minneapolis. And I have been.
Make sure you get ready.
Thanks. I've been doing research on eyewitness memory and police procedures for collection of eyewitness evidence for over 30 years. I think it's very reasonable for a committee such as this, you're evaluating these recommendations, to ask the question as to whether these recommendations are based on sound science. And indeed, they are, absolutely. The scientific research in this area includes thousands of studies on eyewitness memory, studies that look from the lab been conducted in the laboratory under control conditions to understand how eyewitness memory works, when it works well, when it doesn't work so well, and field tests. We want to make sure that the principles in the laboratory that we've established, if you bring them to the field, to real eyewitnesses, to real investigations, real crimes, that these procedures that we recommend work, and they do. They're practicable. They really can work. I'm going to be brief, and I think probably the best support we have for the science here is that recently the National Academy of Sciences, I suspect you're familiar with this, but just for the record, the National Academy is a group of our absolute top scientists across the sciences in this country who are called upon now and then to look at the quality of a set of research findings, to look at the quality of the research, and if appropriate, to make recommendations to the nation, but that would be for the general welfare. And the National Academy of Sciences looked at this body of research about eyewitness science. They started in 2012, completed their work in 2014, and came out with a resounding support. This is good, solid science. And they took it a step further and suggested specific recommendations for procedures that should be used by law enforcement and throughout the court system. And what you're looking at today are among those recommendations. So the science is there, and I know I have to be brief, so perhaps I can stop there and welcome questions if you have them.
Very well, thank you. And then one other testifier as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this forward. I'm Julie Jonas. I'm the legal director with the Innocence Project of Minnesota, and we're here to support this non-controversial, no-cost bill just to make sure that these best practices are being used statewide and not just in the metro area, and that they're being used consistently. The Innocence Project, both locally and nationally, supports this bill because we know that the number one cause of wrongful conviction is mistaken eyewitness identification. It's involved in between 70 and 75% of all DNA exonerations. In about 40% of those cases, the mistaken eyewitness identification is cross-racial. And I think the number that's really important for law enforcement and for this committee as well is to think about that every time the wrong person goes to prison, the right person remains out there at large and is still offending. We know through the DNA exonerations, because in almost half of the cases they have been able to catch the true perpetrator, those actual perpetrators have continued to commit serious felony crimes, including 64 rape, and I think this number is a little bit old, but at least 64 rapes and 17 murders. So it's crucial that law enforcement get the right person in the first place. If we conduct these lineup procedures in the best methods possible, that is more likely to occur, and we're less likely to convict the wrong person. This is non-controversial. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the BCA, has publicly endorsed these policies on their website. As it was mentioned, many of the metro area law enforcement agencies are already doing this. POST is already training new officers in this procedure, and just recently the Minnesota Supreme Court tasked the Rules of Evidence Committee with looking into this area and adopted the recommendation that I think was forwarded up to leaders in both the House and Senate here, that Minnesota adopt a statewide policy that follows the National Academy of Sciences best practices for policies regarding gathering of eyewitness identification. This legislation will affect that recommendation by the Minnesota Supreme Court. It's consistent with what the best practices of law enforcement already are in many metro areas, and all it does is make sure that those best practices are followed statewide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one note, I did hear from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association who had some suggested changes to the language, just addressing a few points, and so would expect that we'll be able to continue to talk those points through. I just want to make sure to note that for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for doing this. I'm on the bill with you. It harkens back to my training, actually, in applied psychology and then later in counseling. And I remember very clearly a class where they had someone sort of kind of walk through the stage back behind the presenter, and then you had to try to figure out who that was. And none of us knew who that was. I mean, they just paid no attention whatsoever. So that sort of began the whole discussion. So I appreciate the testifiers that you have, and obviously you've got decades of studying this. So I appreciate that. I do have a question about what exactly was concerning in the bill from the county attorneys. If you could sort of just point to what their concerns were, that would be wonderful, just so that I can kind of track with the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Neal. I'm pulling out my text here. There were a few points about the use of the word lineup rather than photo. There may be a broader photo array in lines 1.13, 1.16, 1.17, and actually a concern that I had raised earlier. If you look on line 1.17, there's the word match. The fillers used in the lineup match the eyewitness's description. And that seemed potentially concerning. What does match mean? And so the talk was substantially similar rather than that. And I think none of these should be a concern in talking with, in my own assessment, and talking with folks who brought this forward. The one piece is on line 1.11. There's the word that the model policy must require these remaining points. And the suggestion was that the model policy consider those remaining points. I'll admit I had just connected, again, very recently, just via text, with the MCA, so I want to think this through further. The concern is that these 1 through 4 really are best practices, and so there's the question of, how they work with the policy. But as I say, this is something that's very fresh, so I guess I need the chance to sort of think it through. I know that testifiers may have thoughts as well on that point about require versus consider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to hear from them because those are pretty good points to point out that the language doesn't quite match the reality of what we're doing here in Minnesota. So it's good to always, if we have a model policy from another state, it's always good to pull it in, match it up against our own current policies, procedures, and own statute. So I'd be curious to know what his thoughts are. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Pinto, my name is Robert Small. I'm the executive director of the County Attorneys Association, and Representative Pinto did just read a text from me. So he said it better than I. The thought from the County Attorneys Association, and we appreciate the required language versus considered, and the thought from the county attorneys is if you're going to give it to the post board to establish a policy, that we ought to give the professionals the leeway to consider not only those four, but what is the best practice. And that's the reasoning behind the change in that word required to consider. We don't have any problem with the four, but mandating that to the professionals who are more knowledgeable than I.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's why I was really glad to have Judge Small come up, because that's something I hadn't thought of. We don't want to constrain it either. So if these professionals say, hey, you know what, this is great, but we thought of two more, I think that's also important to have that flexibility. So I appreciate you bringing that to light as well.
Very well. Representative Mueller and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really like this bill, too, and I just wanted some clarity around eyewitness identification. If we're talking about just a lineup or photo array, are we also talking about scene identifications? Or I had a case once where a witness walked into court. She'd never been asked to do an identification and said, oh, my gosh, that's him. And so that was, you know, kind of a different scenario. So just, you could just speak to what is meant by eyewitness identification. I think it would be helpful.
Ms. Jonas.
This bill is directed at photo arrays, and one of the recommendations from the county attorney's office was to clarify that language to talk just about photo arrays, and that's absolutely where we're talking about.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Pino. When I first saw this bill, I was wondering where you were getting at, and I get a little bit to understand. We're actually using photo lineups. I've never done an in-person lineup because the vast majority of departments in the state don't have that capability. And I don't know if there's any that actually have that anymore or do that. But with photo lineup, I know the training I had back in the mid-'80s, and any training I've had dealing with that, the stuff you have in your bill is what we were trained on to do already. We do that. I know guy who's talking to my sheriff just yesterday on this bill, and they no longer put the photo lineups together. They have what's called MRAP do them. That way it's the same background, the same size on the photographs, everything is the same. So they're doing a lot of these things already. I'm trying to get make sure that the victim in these situations, if they do identify the right person, they do it for the right reasons. They don't tell her which one it is. They don't know. They keep it silent. And we always ask, how confident are you that the person you picked is the one? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I've done them, and I know that the actual perpetrator was in there. They picked a different person, or they didn't pick anybody at all. It goes back to the game of telephone tag. People, you have somebody, and they always get different answers. So photo lineups are actually not—they're used, but they're not used for, in Minnesota. At least in Minnesota, they're not used for definitive 100%. You did it. It's just one of the key pieces of evidence in a large group of evidence. So, and you did clarify that this is not just the original bill, just lineup. It is for photographs. I appreciate that. And with the amendment that Judge Small would like, I think would clear up some of the issues. But I'm also wondering, BCA has a very good policy. I don't know if you've looked at that or not. It'd be something to look at because it's a policy that is very effective and it actually does the job. So I don't think we need to rebuild it. Maybe just pass it on so everybody's using the same thing.
Representative Pinto.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you, Representative Johnson. No, I was just connecting with the witnesses here and saying the BCA policy is terrific, as I understand it, and certainly could well be adopted. I should say that I feel like sometimes we have concerns that you get sort of a statewide imposition before agencies are ready. And so what I really like about what you're describing, Representative Johnson, is I understand there's been training and work done all around the state. So in a way, that seems like this is coming at it in exactly the right way. You reach out to departments, do training, do work with them. And so then sometimes the model policy maybe is the last piece that falls into place to say, we've now established a standard that we want to make sure agencies are meeting, and most are meeting, maybe even all are meeting. We want to make sure that stays in place. Rather than flipping it around, you put a policy in place before agencies are ready, and you come up with it later. This feels like it's just the opposite. So I guess I view your comments as being real supportive of that approach that's been taken on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
That's what this means.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House File 627 as amended? All right. Well, if not, then Representative Pinto, you get the last word here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thanks to the testifiers, all three of them. Thank you.
Very well. The chair then lays House File 627 as amended over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Ms. Jonas, and thank you, Professor Stebly. And with that, members, we're on our last bill, Representative Mueller. Representative Mueller moves House File 1955 be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. I think I got your motion correct, yes. Representative Mueller, did I?
Yes, thank you,
Very
Mr.
Well.
Chair. So moved.
So House File 1955 is before us. And then you have an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's right.
Okay. So Representative Mueller moves the A190139 amendment. And this, I trust, is to put the bill in the shape you wish it to be at this moment.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Members, all in favor of the A190139 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Mueller, House File 1955, as amended, is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the Department of Public Safety's agency bill. It falls into three different categories. And I think I'm not going to do much talking about it because I have the experts here, and each one will speak to the different sections that are in the bill. So if that's okay, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to my first testifier.
Very well. Welcome to the committee. And whoever's going to go first, give us your name, and I think you know the drill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Katie Engler. I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I will be talking about Article 1 in the bill today. Just as a little bit of background, some of you who were on the committee last year will be familiar with some of the provisions. The bill this year began with where we left off last year. Unfortunately, this language was in the omnibus bill that was vetoed at the end of session and so did not become law. Another piece that you should be aware of is that in 2017, the legislature funded a replacement for the predatory offender registration system. And so some of the issues that we've identified and are bringing forward in the bill relate to that technology refresh that we're working on right now, and I will be pointing out those sections to you. Section 1 amends the provision in state law that governs how a driver's license photograph can be used.
Ms. Engler, let me just interrupt, and I apologize for that. Because we are going through several sections, the chair's desire... we've got, I think, plenty of time to get through the bill, so I think it might be good for members to raise questions as we go along as opposed to having to go back to a particular section that we heard 10 minutes ago. And so we may be interrupting periodically, but I do want to encourage members to do that if they have questions. Please proceed, Ms. Englund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 1 in Article 1 is... the provision related to the use of driver's license photographs. In the state of Minnesota, there are restrictions on how those photographs can be used What we are adding at the top of page 2 is authority for law enforcement who are trying to locate a registered offender to make use of the driver's license photograph for that purpose. Section 2, we make a couple of definitional changes. One in beginning lines 2.12 defines who a corrections agent is and includes the fact that this can be an employee of the federal government. And the next one is in lines 2.20 to 2.23, defining that for purposes of law enforcement authorities, these authorities in particular have to be located within the state of Minnesota. We have had individuals required to register who believe that because they are on a border state that they can somehow interact with law enforcement in that border state and satisfy the requirements of registration. So we just want to make it clear that it's Minnesota only. The next change in Section 3 begins at the bottom of page 3. And the language that you see there that appears to me new is actually rearranging language that is now on line 4.8 to 4.9. What we've done is reformatted this list of offenses to make it easier to read. Right now it's all in one big paragraph. The next provision is 4.16 to 4.20. This would add that individuals who are convicted in another country where there are sufficient safeguards for fundamental fairness and due process would also be required to register should they come to Minnesota. 4.26 to 4.28, right now an individual can come to this state, stay here for 12 days, leave for two, come back for another 12 days, leave for two, and not have to register. And so what the language does in 4.27 to 4.28 is say that if you have that pattern of conduct, once you have an aggregate period of time of 30 days during any calendar year, the requirement to register now applies so that you can't come and go to avoid the registration requirements. The changes on page 5 at the top of the page all relate to the addition of other countries of conviction as a basis for registration. The change that begins on the bottom of page 5 and continues to the top of page 6 is in part of this technology refresh that I spoke about, allowing us to leverage access to information at the court information system to pull information into the predatory offender registration system. The language in 6.5 through 6.8, in reading the language, we noticed that if a corrections agent is assigned to an individual, there are very specific directions about how they are told about the requirements to register, but there wasn't anything when there was no probation agent, and so that's what that new language does. The next change in Section 5 would require people required to register to provide a biological specimen for DNA analysis, and I'll talk about, as we get a little bit farther within this section, about how we would do that. The changes at the top of page 7 relate to that technology refresh, trying to update things so that we're no longer copying things, but rather notifying that kind of thing to make use of the technology. That also applies to the change in 7.30 to 7.31. Part of what we want to be able to do is separate the verification process that we use to confirm that a person actually receives mail at their primary residence from their ability to change information related to their registration requirement. Right now, they can put all of that information together as part of the verification process. We want to separate it in part as we build the technology to meet the requirements of the statute and also to encourage them to more promptly notify us of changes that they are required to provide. Line 8.16 to 8.17 relates to a change that the legislature made last year related to individuals who are leaving the sex offender program who now get a risk level assigned to them through the risk level process at the Department of Corrections. This just gives the Bureau authority to interact with those individuals if there is a need to do so, because Right now, the authority is for those who have been assigned a risk level after incarceration. We're just adding this new notification process that you included last year. Lines 8.23 to 8.27 come out of an actual incident that we were told of in northern Minnesota, where an individual with a probation agent had law enforcement go to that individual's actual physical address to confirm that they were at their primary address, and the individual basically told local law enforcement to leave because they had a probation agent and law enforcement had no right to come to their home. So we are asking you to make it clear that law enforcement can actually go to the addresses that an individual provides as part of their registration to confirm that they are, in fact, at those addresses. And there's some more references to changes related to using another country's conviction to support a registration and reducing the number of times we send a verification to individuals at the sex offender program from 4 times a year to 2 times a year. The deletion of language at the top of page 9 is being requested because we realize we no longer need to do this. Everyone that now is required to register is receiving this information about when they go to a healthcare facility while they are a registered offender. As I indicated earlier, the next language in 9.8 through 9.13 talks about how and when we would collect the DNA specimens from individuals. We are also specifically saying that an individual who has already provided a specimen under state law, existing state law, would already have met the requirement.
Ms. Segler, we have a question from Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just let us know when DNA is already taken? I thought that DNA had already been taken from these folks, but I must be mistaken because now we're adding it in that they're being taken. Can you just explain to the committee when we take DNA samples and when we don't and how this change is different than what we currently do?
Ms. Segler.
Mr. Chair, Representative. State law, section 609.117, says that a DNA sample is supposed to be collected from everyone charged with a felony offense who has been convicted as a result of that charge, whether at a felony level or not, or convicted of an offense that arises out of those same set of circumstances. Unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. And so, yes, there's definitely the individuals who are required to register fall under the same in that they're supposed to be a felony offense charged, and there's a conviction that results from that charge, and it may arise out of the same set of circumstances that forms the basis for the felony. Unfortunately, we pulled information this morning, and right now we have almost not quite 900 individuals who haven't met the current statutory requirements and are required to register. And so what we're doing is seeking for authority for the Predatory Offender Registration Unit to get those samples collected and get the results on file for use either in including an individual or exonerating an individual in a future criminal investigation.
Members, and to the testifier, I just got a notice that we only have the room to one. I always look to squeeze out more time, but apparently we can't do that today. So just, you know, be on notice, to do the walkthrough as quickly as possible. This is the department bill. It certainly will be back before us, but obviously now's the time to understand it fully. Representative O'Neill.
So I was going to do a follow-up in the interest of time, I won't, and if it's coming to judiciary, I will ask in Chair Lesh's committee a little bit of a follow-up, because it's a little concerning that in state statute it says we're supposed to be collecting these samples and we're not, and I wasn't clear if that 900 was the totality of those that are not being collected or only in the sex offender side of it not being collected, and so I was going to ask that follow-up. I can get to that in judiciary, but it's rather concerning.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Ms. Engler, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to move a little more quickly.
Thank you.
So bottom of page 9, adding two different types of information that are required to be provided as part of registration. Just so that you know, the license plate tab expiration is a requirement of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Section 7 on page 10 is part of that technology refresh to allow some additional means for an individual to provide a signature as part of the notice requirement. Section 8 is incorporating what's known as International Megan's Law, which is a federal law into state statute that requires sex offenders to inform the government of their intent to travel outside of the country to give the destination country the opportunity to decline to have them enter. Section 9, the criminal penalty language, is some of the language that was changed in last session. It addresses a case where the individual who was required to register was able to demonstrate that he did not knowingly commit a violation of the statute. Page 12, the new language in the middle of the page is basically moving to make a list from a little bit below, giving you the specific reasons that support a failure to register case. Top of page 13, we do have some individuals who, during the course of their time that they're supposed to register, do not participate. Right now, when they get to the end of their 10-year period, we have to make them inactive. The new language at the top of page 13 would give us an additional 2 years to try to get them into compliance. The other changes on the page relate to other countries of conviction. Top of page 14 and on page 15, we have parallel provisions that control the use of data. There was a change in 2005 that said the corrections agents were supposed to disclose predatory offender status to child protection workers. We are now making that authority clear in these two provisions. The final section is 12, which is about what causes an individual to be placed on our public website by being non-compliant. Right now, there really isn't a definition for that. We are making the list parallel to the one that you just saw for basis of a failure to register case. And with that, that is the end of Article 1.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Very efficient use of time. I appreciate it. Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Moeller, and members of the committee. My name is Dana Wahlberg, and I'm the Director of the Emergency Communication Networks Division of the Department of Public Safety. Initially, we started out with one program. It was the 911 program, and as emergency communications for public safety have grown over the course of the years, particularly after 9/11 and the need for increased interoperability between and amongst agencies and areas, has our program grown. So rather than going through every line, I'm just going to give you what the three primary changes are. One, anywhere there's a reference to the statewide radio board, which was the purpose that our governance structure came into being to help deploy the land mobile radio system for the state. Now that that has pretty much been finished, we've identified the value of that governance structure. So we've changed the name from the Statewide Radio Board to the Statewide Emergency Communications Board, and it now encompasses the other program areas, which include 911, wireless broadband, and integrated public alert and warning. So we're going to model the same governance structure that was so successful with the Land Mobile Radio program and continue it going forward. That was done by a vote of the board in 2013. In 2017, there was two seats added to the board by a majority vote, and that is to include an Indian Affairs seat, Minnesota Indian Affairs Council seat, and a Minnesota Department of Corrections seat. So we'd like to add those. The other change is to change the number of counties that comprise the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board region. That has gone from 9 to 10. Just effective January of 2019, Sherburne County has migrated from the central region to the metro region. And finally, the amendment that the representative mentioned, there specifically in Section 3, Subdivision 1B, it identifies that the The board is not subject to the open appointment law. Yet above that, as it speaks about filling the vacancies for the chiefs of police, fire chiefs, and Minnesota Ambulance Association, it states that there will be a recommendation and then an appointment by the governor. We're removing the language about the appointment from the governor, given the fact that it explicitly states that it's not subject to the open appointment law. So basically, it's all cleanup changes based on the need to keep in step with national emergency communications.
Terrific. Thank you, Ms. Waldron, for your efficient use of time. And I even got it, so thank you. We have a couple minutes left, so I think this is Lieutenant. I'm going to make a try. Rue?
You got it right on there, Chair. Thank you.
Lieutenant Rue, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Mueller for carrying this. So my office is Lieutenant Brian Rue with the State Patrol. My office is tasked with conducting the annual inspections for transportation vehicles equipped with wheelchair securements. The rule that we use to conduct those inspections was adopted in 1979 and is not compliant with ADA, which came out after that fact. So rather than amending the rule, we're looking to essentially just clean up the language by adopting the ADA standard and then taking some of the other parts of the rule and incorporating them into the existing statute that originally gave us the authority for that rule. So Section 1 talks about an approval process by the commissioners, and what we're trying to do is, as long as the device is certified by the manufacturer that it meets ADA standards, it's considered approved versus having to have a separate list that somebody goes on to see if their device they're using is compliant. Subdivision 2, or Section 2 there, is where they're adopting that ADA standard under the Code of Federal Regulations 38.23. Section 4 sets the design standard for lifts. Currently, the statute only gives us the authority or the requirement to inspect the wheelchair securement devices. It does not incorporate the lifts or ramps which would be used to get those vehicles or the wheelchair users into the vehicle. So it sets a design standard for those lifts to make sure that they're also ADA compliant. Subdivision, addition to that, for driver's responsibility, that is an existing rule that is there in rule. We're just moving it into the statute since we're in the process of rescinding the rule. There is the option in there for somebody that if they cannot wear their seatbelt because of some condition would be aggravated, such as like a dialysis pump or something, then they would not have to wear that part of the restraint system. And then Section 5 is talks about the inspection that must be conducted, and we're adding the lifts or ramps to a part of that inspection process. And then the repealers are essentially taking out the transit vehicle rule specific requirement because that is incorporated with the ADA that we're adopting. And then the last repealer is no longer needing that approval process by the commissioner. And then we did consult with the Minnesota Council on Disabilities, and they do not have any oppositions after their technical advisors looked at our language as well. So I'll just add that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for consulting with them. Wow. You three are phenomenally efficient with your use of time. Thank you so much for accommodating our time restrictions, and thank you for the fine work that you do on behalf of our state. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have anything further. I don't know if anybody else wanted to testify or had any questions.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House File 1955 as amended? If not, then Representative Mueller renews her motion that House File 1955 as amended be re-referred to the committee, the Judiciary Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you to the testifiers and Representative Mueller. Members, we'll meet again at our regular time tomorrow at 12:45, and I'll probably see you all on the House floor in a few hours. Until then, this committee stands adjourned.